Welcome back to the Guards Podcast. Today we have the distinct honor of speaking with Chief Warrant Officer 5, Kylie Kuntz, who is the North Dakota Army National Guard Command Chief Warrant Officer. CW5, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Nate. It's good to be here this morning.
No, yeah, definitely appreciate you coming out. And so really what we want to dive into is you became the Command Chief Warrant Officer for the state of North Dakota in May. So we're going on a few months now. But before we get into that, want to look into your early military career and then how you got to this point. So originally you enlisted as a bridge crew member with the 957 Engineer Company, went on a deployment to Iraq, and then it appears you've held basically every single property and or accountability position known to man within like the NCO and Warrant Officer Corps. So we're going to be able to talk about some of those. So you have like property accountability technician, supply sergeant, the central issue facility manager. And then, so just real quick, is it CIF or is it CIF? Because it goes back and forth depending who you talk to. So you got a quick one for that?
It depends on which state you're at.
Okay.
So normally it's CIF.
Okay, because I've heard it both ways here. So
here in North Dakota, most people call it the CIF.
Okay, it threw me off at first. I was like, wait a second, we're talking the same thing. So perfect. So you were the manager there, and then you also became the property management branch chief. Took another deployment that time to Afghanistan in support of Operation Freedom Sentinel, and now you're the command chief warrant officer for North Dakota. So that's about the 20 to 30 second wrap up. But what initially got you into the North Dakota National Guard, and what put you on the warrant officer path?
So, you know, like most people that join the North Dakota Army National Guard, I grew up on a farm in south central North Dakota in the Iron Curtain, for those of you that are familiar, deep in the heart of the Iron Curtain. And my parents were farmers, and I wanted to, you know, it was the late 90s, and I wanted to do something with my life, and I needed to find a way to pay for college, and I wanted to go to college. So that was initially one of the main reasons why I joined. Another reason that I joined is because my family has a long history of military service. You know, my grandpa, two of my aunts, my uncles, my dad served in the Guard also. And so it was kind of a family history. I was familiar with it, and they were very proud to have served. So there was that. And then also we had a gentleman that became a recruiter from the area. He was from Zealand, and he started recruiting all those of us that he knew. And so then there was the delayed entry program. So we would have guys go into drill on the weekends, and then they'd come back to high school, and they'd have their cool shiny combat boots on, and told us all about all the cool things they were doing at drill. And so that's part of the reason why I joined the Guard specifically. Another reason was I thought, well, you know, they'll help me pay for college, and if I don't like it, if it's not the greatest thing I ever did, I only have to do it one weekend a month and 2 weeks a year.
Yeah, definitely something you can stomach if it's
right. Yeah.
Not digging this. So, what made you pick to be a bridge crew member? Is that just because, all right, closest armory to my hometown, or is it like that's something cool? I think I want to do that. That's something I can do one weekend a month.
Yeah. So when I got in, I've been in a while, and so there weren't as many options for females at that time. So when I got in, knowing what I know now, they only had vacancies as bridge crew members and as 92 Golfs, cooks. And I said, well, nobody wants to eat my cooking, trust me. And building bridges seemed really cool. And it was what the guys that were in my high school were doing. So I thought, well, that would be cool. And it was right here in Bismarck, so that was great. And I wanted to drive the boats.
Yeah, definitely. All right, get me on the river.
Love yeah, it. Yeah.
So you did that, and then that's where you deployed to Iraq as well, is with that unit. So you want to talk to me a little bit about that? Like, what did you do on that deployment? What did you learn from it?
Sure. So I had been a traditional drilling soldier for about, I think at that point, 8 years. And I had actually recently gotten hired on in the central issue facility. That's where I started. And then I moved over to the warehouse as a material handler, and I was doing that job. And then the 957 supply sergeant job opened up at AGR, Active Guard and Reserve. And at that point, I was like, you know, I'm pretty good at the supply thing. I started to figure out from the top down, from the USPFO and the warehouse side, and I thought that would be a good fit for me because I really liked logistics. I loved building bridges. Don't get me wrong. I loved it. Lived and breathed for it. But I was like, you know, for my future, I had finished my associate's degree at Bismarck State College, and I was kind of just wandering, you know, figuring out what I was going to do. So I applied for that AGR position and got it in November, and we got alerted for activation, you know, after 9/11, And so I took the AGR position in late November. I think it was like the 20th of November, and we got alerted in early January. So I had been the unit supply sergeant for about a month when we had a 30 days to get out the door with all of our equipment. So talk about learning a job hard and fast. That is certainly something that I did.
So definitely trial by fire. So yeah. You just get into the role. You have some understanding.
Yeah.
Right? So you have that background. Obviously, they hired you in the position because they're like, okay, this person knows supply. They're working over here and they can understand it. But what were some of the challenges of just like, all right, it's go time. You got 30 days.
Yeah.
We're working long days. You need to get everything out the door for this unit.
Yeah. So I've told this story for 30 years. So for those people who have ever listened to me give a briefing and stuff, they would ask me questions like, hey, do you have all the tools in this toolbox? And I would say, I have no idea. You know, I don't know that we had been doing, you know, because at that point this was the first time that the Guard had really been mobilized in mass in decades. And so, you know, inventories sort of were going by the wayside maybe a little bit, and things like that. So it was just figuring out what we had, if it was serviceable, if we could use it, and we didn't have time to fix it. You know, we were out the door. Fortunately, the 957 that spring and fall had gotten all new trucks. So, you know, our equipment was in good shape, but all those other ancillary things were, in the wind, we weren't sure. So that was a big challenge just getting out. And then, for me, one of the biggest challenges was not understanding logistics, from a strategic level, right? So I was at the unit supply level and I was counting things and trying to get Band-Aids and things like that, but I didn't necessarily understand where the Band-Aids were coming from and why I couldn't get them when I needed them and things like that. Band-Aids is an example, but and that's when I started looking at learning, really digging in, why I couldn't get things, why I could get things. Funny story that I was actually just telling last week at a retirement for one of my fellow 957 soldiers was when we got to Iraq, I started ordering things just to see if I could get them. Right? Because that's sort of what you do, right? And I ordered ISU 90s, which are like those half conexes, you know, those 10-foot conexes. And I had put in the NSN and I found it and they were expendable. And I put the NSN in and I ordered them and, sent it over to the warehouse and whatever. I was over there picking up brooms and, you know, things like that, garbage bags. And one day I get a call from the warehouse and they said, your conexes are here, or you have something to pick up. And I went over there and I saw that I had four of these ISU 90s that had come in. I could not believe it. It was crazy. And those ISU 90s are still in service. Barely. We're getting ready to turn them in today.
Yeah, but that long ago, you ordered them, worked the system, got them to come in.
Yeah, that was so exciting. I was so excited. And they were a really great thing for us to have over there. And so to see them now getting turned in makes me a little sad.
Yeah. Just assign them to someone like, all right, there's your Connex. Use it for what you need.
Yeah.
Your padlock, here you go.
Yeah, and they've been using them ever since then, you know. So talk about being able to leave your mark somewhere. It was cool.
Do you have a hidden, you know, tag, signature, or unit logo you hid somewhere on them?
No, I'm not that clever.
No, so definitely seems like you think that supply sergeant position really mattered, but looking through a lot of the other ones, you know, either in the managerial role or the technician role, what do you think are some other really key positions you've had that helped cut your teeth as a warrant officer or even before you became a warrant officer?
Sure. While I was in Iraq, you know, I think you're going to get to that one. So one of the most significant roles was, of course, when I first took my appointment as a warrant officer, they stationed me up at the RTI as their property book officer. And at that point, I had been working with their property. And the RTI is a very interesting place if you've never served there. It's really cool because they have, you know, a really, really cool mission. And they're always working with soldiers from all over the nation and things like that. So I was stationed up there as a warrant officer. It was really cool because they had a lot of really great leadership up there, but also I was able to cut my teeth on real things that would really impact because they use that equipment every day. And so that was really a cool assignment, and I really enjoyed that.
So then some people might not understand, like the RTI here, you did say it trains people from all throughout the United States. You know, soldiers come here, different components, And it's not just like, okay, they can't just wait on their supplies. It's, we need it to go now. We need it to work. We need to have everything there. So they can train on basically a lot of trade skills.
Yes.
And they need to have the toolboxes to be filled.
Yes.
So.
Yes. And they need the things now. And also it was a fairly new supply staff up there. They have a pretty robust staff, but they were all pretty new. So I was able to teach him lessons that I had just learned from being deployed and being a supply sergeant myself. So I was able to help them, and most of them went on to become really, really great logisticians and retire as logisticians.
So then you did that role. So what got you into the warrant officer branch? Like, what was the moment someone said, hey, you should do this? Or was it just you saw a poster and you decided to do it? Or what was that moment?
So, you know, I was always one of those soldiers that when I saw what I called brass and ammo coming, officers or senior NCOs, I would run the other way because I just didn't want to have anything to do with that. I wanted to do my job. And I wanted to just do my job and not be messed around with. And when we deployed to Iraq, I worked with some really awesome warrant officers. That's really where I got my first exposure to warrant officers kind of more en masse, because in the 957, we only had one maintenance warrant officer who I didn't work with a ton until I became the supply sergeant, and then I did. And he was awesome, Mr. Filling. But when we deployed, the warrant officers were the ones behind the scenes making the things happen, right? So that warrant officer at that warehouse that got me those ISU 90s, you know, let that requisition go through, and working with different property book officers at different levels, at the brigade and at the battalion level, was really cool. And they were always super knowledgeable, super helpful, and very, very willing to teach you. And I learned a ton from them. And so when I came back from Iraq, you know, I was back in the supply sergeant role and doing the supply sergeant stuff. And I looked around and raised my head for a minute and thought, you know, I like this AGR thing. I like this being full time with the guard. And this is probably a good fit for me. And so I thought, you know, if I'm going to do this, I would like to be a warrant officer, because I would, at that point, I was like, you know, I'd really like to teach and mentor and just be really, really good at my job. And so that's kind of what drew me to it.
Yeah. So that was in 2007, you commissioned as a quartermaster warrant officer. So it seems like you kind of laid out why you want to do that role. But has your focus evolved throughout your career? Is like, obviously, everything you're doing now is for the entire warrant officer corps, not just quartermaster warrant officer. So what's been some changes you've seen of, okay, you need to make an even broader approach for the entire warrant officer corps rather than just logisticians?
So we have warrant officers, they used to, it's an old term, I don't know if they use it anymore, but they call it WOPA, the Warrant Officer Protection Agency. And it was always just kind of a slang term that we would talk about at school, at warrant officer schools. But what's so cool about warrant officers is they never let another warrant officer fail, right? So the Warrant Officer Protection Agency is one of those things where, like, I am not an admin. I'm not a 420 alpha, and my admin knowledge is very limited. But if I go and ask a 420 alpha question, they're going to bend over backwards to help me. And quartermaster works hand in hand with maintenance and ordnance, you know, so working with them and learning their side of the story, so to speak, versus the quartermaster side, you know, learning how to work together so that things work seamlessly, you know, and so that's super cool. Making sure that those warrants out in the ADA, those 140 alphas, have what they need and the equipment that they need and the updates that they need. So especially in the state of North Dakota, warrant officers, we stick together. We're a tight group, and we make sure that we all work together and make sure each other succeeds.
So we talked a little bit about that first deployment and then some other positions, but then you also had a deployment to Afghanistan for Freedom Sentinel. At that time, you were a warrant officer.
Yes.
So what was that deployment? What were you doing there? What was your, like, key tasks?
So in Afghanistan, they pulled me into the 136 CSSB, and we served in Bagram. But what I got to do there, I've never actually deployed in my actual MOS. When I deployed with the 957, I was still a 12 Charlie bridge builder. I hadn't had time to go to MOSQ. So I have never deployed in my MOS. when I went to Afghanistan, I got to run the largest warehouse in the Army. And they were doing up to 5,000 transactions a day, because they were at that point in, that was the latter part of Afghanistan, and they had consolidated all of the warehouses to Bagram. So we were pushing out up to 5,000 parts, pieces, aircraft pieces out to all of the areas of Afghanistan that needed support. I had a staff of 125. Most of those were foreign nationals, Bosnians, and then some Jordanians, and then also some expats. So we had about 45 expats. So it was the largest warehouse in the Army. That was super cool, because I got a real strategic experience, right? So I was, because it was such a large and high visibility warehouse, I was working with DA, people up at DA, people in Kuwait. You know, I was on all kinds of meetings and determining what we needed to stock and how we could increase things. And the people that, the soldiers that in the 136 that I worked with over there, they were so awesome. They were such a great team. And we were able to speed up deliveries by like 5 days, you know, so talk about making a difference. And, you know, I was able to, once I got my feet under me a little bit, because I wasn't working in my MOS, I'm a property book officer, not a 920 Bravo, which is a warehouse supervisor. And so once I got my feet under me, then of course I had to cause a ruckus and try and make things better, right? And improve things. And, improve efficiencies and improve the way we were doing things. And so that deployment was really, really valuable to me based on the strategic. I got to see how the other side works, got to work at that strategic level and really got to make a difference. So that was super cool.
So definitely a guardism of, okay, I'm here for this amount of time.
Yeah.
Let me figure it out. And then, all right, what can I do to improve it now?
Yes.
Because I'm going to be gone.
Totally. Totally. So it was really, really a wonderful experience. And like I said, the team that they assigned to me of 136 soldiers that I worked with were absolutely phenomenal. And they had my back and we did really good things. It was awesome.
So if you had to like really pinpoint some of the top aspects of what were you able to do to make that process faster? Was it like just getting people in the right spots, or was it like automation that you were doing, or was it like, oh, here's a way of efficiency we can inside the warehouse and make things flow smoother?
A little bit of both. And then also the soldiers that I had working with me were just so fantastic and so efficient, right? So my team got over there and we looked for efficiencies and we looked for ways to fix the system so that in such a way that we weren't having delays. And I'll start talking techie on you if I go any further, but you know, and then tracking those shipments and making sure those shipments were tracked properly so that it you know, the customer on the ground might not know that shipment got there. That way they would know. And just working with the units that were coming and going, because we had a ton. One of the things that we fixed or worked to fix was there was like a lot of lumber, a ton of lumber. And what was happening is, now I'm going to get technical. I don't want to do that too much. But what was happening is, like, say you would order an 8-foot piece of wood, like an 8-foot 2x4. Well, they didn't have an 8-foot 2x4, so they would send a 10-foot 2x4. And the system didn't recognize that the 10-foot was the substitution for the 8-foot. And once we realized that, we worked to fix that in the system. So what was happening for probably 2 years prior to me getting there is lumber was just coming and coming and coming, and they were stocking it. But the customer never got the lumber because they were waiting for a 2x4x8, and a 2x4x10 came. So those customers weren't getting the lumber that they had ordered, but it was stockpiling in the warehouse. So once we determined that, we made the change, and the customers started to get their lumber because they were building things. And also, we were able to save the Army, you know, I can't even imagine how much money overall, because they stopped shipping us lumber that we were just stocking. So, and then I also put a list out to my customers and said, hey, man, this is what I have in the warehouse right now. You can come over and pick it up. And that built efficiencies and relationships at a strategic level. You know, we shipped some lumber out to Jordan because we had so much. It was crazy. So that was one of the major things we did, for sure.
And just that as an example, I mean, all right, you don't have the 8-foot. I'll take the 10. Because I can find something to do with that 2 extra feet.
Exactly. And the customers were grateful because some of them have been waiting for stuff for 6 months. And they hadn't realized that it was coming in, but it was just not issuing. So it was a problem with the system a little bit, a problem with the shipper a little bit, but we fixed it. And that was awesome.
We talked about the deployments. And then so something else is formal education within the Warrant Officer Corps. So you've completed, you know, the gamut, basic, advanced, intermediate, and then the senior service courses for your education. But how important are those education opportunities for warrant officers? And then what do they do to develop an effective warrant officer?
Sure. So they're obviously super important because oftentimes you can't get promoted to the next rank unless you have the previous military education completed. So there is that. But speaking from my experience, of course, they've made a ton of changes to warrant officer professional military development, military education over the last year. And so the courses have changed and the names have changed, and it's been a long time since I've been to school. So I can only speak from past experience. But what I gleaned from my professional military education as a warrant officer was in the younger ranks, they're working more on your technical skills. They're working to sharpen your technical skills so that you are the technical expert. And that's really awesome because, you know, we do things a certain way here in North Dakota, right? And they do things a certain way in Mississippi, and they do things a certain way, you know, in 54 kingdoms, countries, and territories, as you say. And so the networking there is super awesome because on the technical side, you know, the Warrant Officer Corps only makes up 3% of the Army. And so we're a small cohort, right? So it's possible that if you've gone to your basic course or your intermediate course or advanced course with someone, you're probably going to encounter them again, right? And so that networking is super great. And also getting different perspectives from other technical experts on how they're doing things in their state is really, really cool in those lower levels, like when you're a CW2 and a CW3. When you get to the CW4 and 5 level, you know, they're pushing more for that strategic thinking and that strategic, the ability to be able to integrate yourself into a staff at the battalion and the brigade level. So that because you've spent most of your career now as a CW2, CW3, being the technical expert and working it with the, you know, working in the shop, doing the things. And then you get to W4 and W5, and now you're overseeing the things, and you're now on a staff. And so the professional military education for warrant officers at that point is teaching you how to integrate yourself into there, how you can make sure that that commander knows what an asset you are. And that's basically where they're going. Now, they've made a lot of changes, so if you want real good answers, you'd have to talk to somebody who's been to school more recently than me. I've been around a long time. I've been to school a while ago. But there is no greater feeling, I can tell you, than getting that last 1059 in your hand, knowing that you've completed all of your professional military education. That's an awesome feeling.
Yeah. Then hopefully they will. Oh, we need one more.
Yeah.
We reach the top. We give you one more to do.
One more, yeah. And they have. They have added one more for CW5s, but I don't have to attend that one, luckily.
So we talk about integrating into the staff with mm-hmm. warrant officers, and as you know, the chief warrant officer for the state of North Dakota, you're in a lot of the meetings to brief senior leadership as well as, you know, officers in charge of their units. Why is it so important to place the emphasis on the Warrant Officer Corps for senior leaders to know, for the units to know, of like, this is what our Warrant Officer Corps is doing?
I think that, you know, again, we're only 3% of the Army. And for a lot of leaders, they've really maybe only worked with one or two warrant officers throughout their career, right? So, like, you know, at the company level, oftentimes it's only a maintenance warrant. And once they get to the battalion level, maybe they're working with a PBO and a maintenance warrant. And then they get up to the staff level, and there's all these warrant officers everywhere. And, you know, we're all very special, and we're all quirky in our own way. But I think that it's important when I'm in the room with those senior leaders to make sure that they understand what skills and experience that those warrant officers bring to those staffs and how important their input is. Because a lot of times I always joke, you know, sometimes those operations guys come up with all kinds of plans. And I always joke that it was my job to pour a little water on them. Not to be, you know, unproductive or unhelpful, but sometimes they don't realize the limitations of their equipment, for example, right? So an example would be the Raven. The Raven was a big thing. It was the UAS that the a recon UAS that units had. Well, you really couldn't fly it in winds over 10 miles an hour. So these operations guys on staffs were building in all these elaborate plans where they were using the Raven. And the reality was that they probably weren't going to be able to use it if the wind was over 10 miles an hour. So that I went off on a tangent there. That one, that's a funny one. That's a funny story between me and a couple of other warrant officers. But anyway, for senior leadership to understand that what the value that the warrant officer brings is that we have that technical expertise, right? And we can keep those systems running and we can provide you with that information. You know, we can let you know, hey, sir, you know, your plan to be, your SPs are off because that truck only goes 55 miles an hour, right? And to have that input into senior leadership with regard to, oftentimes warrant officers are the backbone of units in some cases, right? So warrant officers tend to serve in positions for a little bit longer than senior, maybe senior NCOs and senior officers, just because of the nature of their jobs, right? But a warrant officer maybe have been in that unit for five years, and they have, you know, 15 years of experience behind them. So you get some of these lieutenants and captains, and those warrant officers are really the backbone of that unit, and they know the culture and they know the equipment, and they're able to provide that kind of expertise to them. And I think that reminding those senior leaders the value that those warrant officers bring to those units is something that is important for the CCWO to do. That answer your question?
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. At the end of the day, you talk about the experience. They have time already as NCOs.
Yes.
It's not just a fresh off the street. All right, you're now a warrant officer because you get this, you know, education requirements. Nope, you need to have some experience as well, because we don't want you just to be, you know, fresh.
Yeah, right. And warrant officers, you know, we play that really unique role because, yes, like you said, most of us have been, with the exception, there's few exceptions, but most of us have been at least an E5 or an E6 enlisted. And so we've been an NCO. And so we're able to bridge that gap, too, between officers and NCOs. We're kind of the middlemen, you know. We're still involved. We're out there with the soldiers, but we also understand strategic operations and things like that. So we're really a unique asset, I think, in a unit.
So you talk about that unique asset as well as, you know, the unique role of the National Guard with the state and federal missions. So we talk about it, you know, you explained it perfectly with what warrant officers do on deployments, but we start looking at things like a state mission with, you know, fighting wildfires, you know, combating flooding, even COVID response here in the state. How do warrant officers support not just combat operations, but also in-state domestic response that we do?
That's a good question. And again, I think we still provide that value with our experience and with our technical expertise, right? So we might not be operating our traditional combat, for example, as a quartermaster, a GCSS Army or ordnance, or for a 420 Alpha like IPSA, we're not operating in those systems, but we have that extensive background knowledge of the way that information and things should flow, right? So even though we're not working in our systems, we're adding value with the fact that we can logically and strategically look through how a process should be, how processes should run, and we can advise senior leaders on that. Those skills that warrant officers have, those innate skills with regard to leadership and mentorship of soldiers, I think that's important on state active duty, state missions as well, in that, you know, we've been around the block, most of us, for a while. And, you know, we can help to keep that culture or attitudes positive. And I think that's really, really valuable for a unit.
Then transitioning a little bit, looking in towards the future, with your role as the CCWO for the North Dakota Army National Guard, what are you looking to, like, you know, try and improve, like, work on, like, key priorities that you see as your role, what you really want to focus on in the position?
So, obviously, we always want to make sure that every commander in the state has their warrant officer positions filled. So I work with the warrant officer strength manager and recruiting to try and fill those positions, which is always important. But it takes a while to grow a warrant officer, right? So even if you're out there and you're an E4 and you think, oh, well, I have to be an E5 or an E6 to be a warrant officer, yes, but you have the opportunity now to get yourself ready, right? So learn those technical skills, become an NCO, get to school, get those good NCOERs, prove that you're the technical expert, and become a warrant officer. Because the beauty of being a warrant officer is you still get to do your MOS that you love, and you know, you get to influence commands, which is awesome. As far as future, the Army is developing new warrant officer MOSs all the time. They just came out with one that's it's a 130 Alpha, which is a robotics technician. That's a brand new one. Those are only right now in Special Forces units, and they're working with drones, right? So what I see is as the Army starts to transform and do all of this transformation and all of this automation and technology improvements, I see the warrant officers playing an even more critical role, because you're going to need more technical experts and you're going to need more technicians working on that complex equipment. And so I see the role of warrant officers becoming even more important as the years go by.
If you had to talk about any insight or experiences that you would really want new warrant officers or potential warrant officers to know, what are you looking for in those warrant officers as they bring their own experiences into the career field? Or like, why should they join that warrant officer corps? Who should they talk to and get the process going?
Sure. So the number one thing I would say is if you're thinking about becoming a warrant officer, you should do it. Like I was saying, I have a lot of regrets in my life, but becoming a warrant officer has never, ever been one of them. It's one of the greatest things that I ever chose to do. And being a warrant officer is an honor. It's been a great honor. But, you know, if you are thinking about becoming a warrant officer, what you want to do is make sure that you meet a feeder MOS for those technical warrants. Aviation's a little different. So if you're thinking about becoming an aviator, talk to the warrant officer strength manager. Or if you're thinking of becoming a warrant officer at all, talk to the warrant officer strength manager, which right now is second lieutenant Matthew Wolf, and talk to recruiting or talk to me. Definitely give me a call, look me up. My number is on all the marketing things. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. But one of the key things is that you are a technical expert, that you've worked hard in your MOS, and that you meet the qualifications, and that you have really good NCOERs, that your senior leadership is saying that you should be a warrant officer, that you have those technical skills. Another thing I think that's really important for warrant officers is, you get into the psychoanalyst or stuff about personal and positional power. I think that one of the great skills that most warrant officers have is the ability to wield personal power rather than positional. And that personal power is the ability to influence people just by who you are and what you know. And that is one of those key components to being a successful warrant officer, I think. So if you are thinking about becoming a warrant officer, like I say, give me a call, talk to the warrant officer strength manager, talk to anybody at recruiting, give them a call. And they'll take a look at you and let you know if you meet the qualifications. And it's a great team to be on. Trust me, that Warrant Officer Protection Agency is awesome.
Yep. So all that change from, well, if it's 1 week in a month and I hate it, I can be done, to here you are a few years later.
A few years later. Yes.
Looking at it. So joining us today was Chief Warrant Officer 5, Kylie Kuntz, who is the Army National Guard Command Chief Warrant Officer for the state of North Dakota. Thank you so much for joining us today on the DeGuards podcast. It was excellent having you as a guest to talk about the Warrant Officer Corps.
Thanks for having me. It was awesome talking to you.
All right. And look forward to everyone listening in the future.